Okay, welcome back to End on End. I'm Brian.
I'm Jeff.
And today we are talking about the first proper full band Discord release, Scream, Still Screaming. I love this album. I got it right after it came out, and I've got a lot to say. But first, let's do the check-in, man. How you been, Jeff?
Good. It's been a good week. More of the same, staying home and all that. But it was my wife's birthday last weekend, so we made a nice 3-day weekend out of it. Did some biking. Actually, ate outside at a restaurant for the first time in months. Mm. So it was all good. Looking forward to doing this episode, of course, really because I know how much this record means to you. So I'm really looking forward to hearing all that you have to say about it. How was your week?
My week was good. It was, I don't know. I can barely remember my week, honestly. I feel like I just worked and worked and worked and barely slept. But it wasn't bad. Last weekend, I did get into the city, into San Francisco, and was able to meet up with a friend and walk around with my partner, IU. And it's pretty trippy to walk around a city when it's all boarded up and things half open and people, you know, looking like they live in a pandemic. But yeah, we went to a farmer's market. That part was nice. Anyway, it's just good to be out. It's good to be out. And yeah, things are kind of taking a step back here in California as far as opening and all that sort of thing. But, you know, we're riding it out. So otherwise, as I said last week, broken record here, itching to play some music. Hopefully that's sooner than later. Been writing some stuff and working on this and the other podcast, Out My Way, which I put out last week, the first episode with David Fair. That was, felt good to get that out. So, yeah, I've just been working, connecting with as many of my old friends as I can. You know, that feels good.
Definitely feels to get back in touch and see people. And a friend of mine has been kind of doing movies in the backyard, like projecting onto his house. So I think we're going to head over there at some point and do that. And yeah, and I did check out your other podcast. Sounded good, Out My Way. And yeah, half Japanese centric episode. And actually, I'm going to make a quick little half Japanese reference in a minute or two.
Okay.
But first, I do want to bring up that I did, we brought up in the Iron Cross episode that someone named Mad Monty had a songwriting credit on Crucified. And I asked Saab, I messaged him over the week, and I asked him, who's Mad Monty? And he didn't really sound like he actually knew exactly who he was, but he said it was someone that Mark and Dante knew, and they had played in a band together before Iron Cross. He thinks it may have been Broken Cross.
Yeah, that was their band.
But he, right, that was one of the bands. I think they had been in a couple of bands. But he thinks he may have been in Broken Cross, but he wasn't 100% sure. So, I don't know. I wonder if Mad Monty is, like, collecting royalty checks, like, whenever someone buys an Agnostic Front record that has on or something. I don't know. I also received a nice package from Rob Moss, who was the bass player in Artificial Peace and also did some time in Government Issue. I think we talked about him a little bit when we did the Flex Your Head episode, but I got a couple of nice things from him. I got his book, Descending Memphis, which came out in 2015 and was published by Valor Books. It's a detective novel. It's like a piece of noir fiction. He was nice enough to sign it and personalize it for me. It's going to probably take me a little bit of time to get into it. I have a few books ahead of it, and I'm not the fastest reader in the world. But I will get to it. And, you know, he told me just to tell people that the best way to get that is probably through Amazon. Mm. And Rob also has returned to music after a 35-year absence. He just put out a record called We've Come Back to Rock and Roll. You could buy it for $10 on his Bandcamp page, but if you're out of work, you get a 50% discount. And it's got 14 songs. Like I said, it's the first time he's, I think, played music since Government Issue. But it's his, yeah, he said it's his first recording in over 35 years. And it's an interesting concept he's got. He's got 14 songs, and every song has a different lead guitarist on it. And he's really got some heavy hitters. I mean, he's got guys who were in Generation X. He's got Brian Gay, who was in Government Issue. Nels Klein, who's in Wilco.
He's a monster.
I'm more familiar. He's a monster, very prolific guitarist, and I know him from his work with Mike Watt. I think I saw him play a couple of times with Mike Watt. Don Fleming from the Velvet Monkeys, and if I'm not mistaken, he did some time in Half Japanese.
He did, yeah.
Yep. Spitsticks from Fear, great drummer. He plays on a couple of songs. And relevant to this episode, Franz Stahl plays guitar on a song called Oxygenate. And I gave the album a once over, one listen, and it's not what you would expect from someone who is in Artificial Peace and Government Issue. It's definitely a little more roots rock and roll. The first band that came to mind was the New York Dolls. Just kind of has that sort of New York proto punk kind of sound to it. So if you want to check it out, the best way to get that is through his Bandcamp, which is skin-tight-rock.bandcamp.com. I think that's what I got to say before we get into it.
Well, actually, now that you mention that record, there's a couple that, you know, I'd like to just give a brief mention to. Like, I don't know if you've heard, you know, the latest Discord, the Corky record. Have you given that a spin at all?
Not at all. I only heard the first single they released a few months back, and I remember liking it. But no, I have not listened to the new album yet.
So I've given it a good couple of listens, and you know, I on a very previous episode when they did release that first single, you know, I kind of badmouthed it. Badmouthing's a strong word, but it didn't touch me at all. It didn't feel like a very, I don't know, realized song for them, for the pedigree of everyone involved. But I have to say, after listening to the full album, there's some really good stuff on there. What Joe especially brings to the band is really good, man. He is such a good bass player, and it brings out a jazzy side to Ian's guitar playing too, which it's fun to hear. It's like a jazzier, lo-fi, Fugazi type of thing going on. And more, you know, it's their own thing. It doesn't sound like they're trying to sound like their old band, of course. I can't wait to really ingest it fully, so.
Well, we're going to be getting into that record very soon.
Very soon.
in a short 4 years, I think, we'll be...
Yeah, if we're lucky.
We'll be getting to that.
Yeah, and I'll give a brief mention as well to this. I've only listened to, you know, the first handful of tracks because I just started listening to it, literally. But, you know, our guest today, Enoch Skeeter Thompson, his solo album is really damn good, man. It's really strong. It's got some good melodic punk, some kind of garagey stuff. It's pretty soulful. I was stoked. You know, these when band members do things in their own name, it doesn't always turn out so effective, but he did a really good job. Like, I can't wait to really get into the full album. He's released it under Skeeter Enoch Thompson Inc., and the album is called Book of Enoch in E minor. Good stuff.
Good. I will have to check that out, especially now that my head is sort of, you know, in scream world.
Scream world. Yeah. So. Yeah. Did you? Speaking of which, did you? I don't know if you mentioned it. Someone else did. Because I made that mistake for a split second. On YouTube, there is a documentary called "Scream Still Screaming," and it is nothing to do with the band Scream. It's about the movie.
It's about the movie. I made that mistake. I saw Scream Still Screaming. Well, of course, this naturally has to be about the band, and Nope. They made a like a documentary about the film Scream. Oh, you know what? I did see a very cool, it's not Discord related, but a very cool documentary that just came out. I think Razor Cake has been putting out a series of East Bay short documentaries, and one just came out a couple of days ago on the Stains, the old East East LA band, the Stains, who SST put out their only record like a few years after they had already broken up, but it's like a classic record, and I have it. I mean,
oh, you've got it?
It's a pretty hard. Oh yeah, yeah. I actually bought it right from SST, probably around 1986 or 87. Mm. So I bought it for $10, but it's a pretty rare find now. But they do a like a little 15-minute documentary on it. So anyone who's into that band, I would definitely check that out because it was pretty neat, and they got three of the guys who were in the band to participate.
Yeah, yeah, and I saw that. I mean, I didn't watch it, but I saw that that came out. I'm definitely interested to see that too. And speaking of them, I don't know if you've checked out any of the Henry Rollins cool quarantine streaming shows that he's done, these mammoth 4-hour radio shows that are online.
No, I've heard about them, but I have not watched any of them.
Yeah, they're really good. And he does one where he plays, I think it's the second episode, where he plays the entire Stains album. And, you know, he gives a lot of good background and stories about them before he plays it. And that's definitely worth hearing. And speaking of, you know, Discord, he's played the first Minor Threat demo on there, as well as the full Rain album. You know, he's definitely still steeped in his history.
Well, I know Rollins was always a big supporter of that record. He's talked about them before, and I know he's played their songs before when he's done radio shows. So he's definitely a big proponent, and he's mentioned in the documentary. But anyone who wants to find it, the YouTube channel it's on is Razorcake Gorski. That's one word, Razorcake, and Gorski is spelled G-O-R-S-K-Y. And it's just called East Side Punks Episode 3, Stains. And he has two other, obviously, Episode 1 and 2 also covers some bands from East LA who I was a little less familiar with. A band called The Undertakers and another band called The Brat. So I think those are bands. But Stain ones is great. Anyone, because they're a bit of a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, they're not a whole lot out there about them. Their album is something of a, you know, a bit of a holy grail for some people. I'm very lucky to have it. So it's a cool little documentary. It's good to see that the three participating members of the band all look pretty alive and look pretty well and healthy.
Wow.
Too. So it's good to see.
That's impressive, because everything I've heard is that they ran with a very scary crowd. So
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. So
cool.
So before we get into Scream, I think we should sort of take stock, because I kind of feel like the Scream album is the start of a new chapter.
Definitely.
With Discord. We're turning the page on a year. I mean, this album was recorded in 1982, but it's the first Discord release of 1983. So we've had 8 proper releases so far and 3 split releases. It's about, I'm a numbers guy, so I kind of tallied it up. It's about 2 to 2.5 hours of music that Discord has released up to this point. But 1983, I mean, most says the Flex Your Head. Flex Your Head is the longest release so far, and clocking in at a little over 40 minutes. But 1983, I mean, a pretty big year for hardcore in general. Some big albums come out this year. I mean, Discord obviously has quite a few seminal records, but this is the year that Rock for Light came out, Golden Shower of Hits, a pair of Minutemen records, What Makes a Man Start Fire, Buzz O'Harrell and Under the Influence of Heat. It's the end of the original Misfits run. Sonic Youth was still getting started. They put out their second record. So it's a, you know, and well, probably maybe the biggest one is the first Suicidal record came out in 83. So a pretty big year in hardcore overall, and definitely for Discord too.
Yeah. I was tempted to add like a handful of other records to that list, because, yeah, 83 is a banner year for early hardcore, absolutely. Kind of the, in some senses, the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning of that early, just kind of pure hardcore, before it branched out into all the different other styles.
Right. We're still sort of the end of the rudimentary phase of hardcore. I think Mommy's Little Monster also came out in 83. That was on my list, and I don't know how I missed saying that one, but definitely I think really the breakup of Minor Threat, and I mean the actual 1983 breakup of Minor Threat, because I kind of feel like Minor Threat was sort of, one of the banner bands for that original rudimentary style. I mean, obviously, we'll be talking about Out of Step in a couple of weeks, but I think with their breakup, it really sort of solidified. It put a stamp on the end of that first wave. Not that there aren't bands to this day that still play that, but we've now begun to branch off, and hardcore is evolving, as any musical style that's worth anything should.
Right. I agree, man. Definitely. And, I've got the list pulled up right now, the Discord catalog, and we'll probably say it again once we get to there, but it's pretty amazing. And there's a story behind it, which we'll get to, but 1984 for Discord, all it is two re-releases, compilation re-releases, and one proper. So it's interesting. 1984 was kind of the make it or break it year for that, for Discord coming up.
It's I in my head, I kind of always compare Discord and SST. And SST did take a few years to get to around 1983, 84, but at that point, they put out like 100 records or something ridiculous like that in 1984, whereas, like you say, I mean, there's really only one bona fide new release in 1984. It really wasn't until really the late 80s or even the early 90s that you began to see Discord releases kind of in bulk a little bit.
All right, Jeff, ready to open up the history book on this one?
I'm definitely, and I like that, unlike some of the other bands we covered, we're really going to get to follow the Scream history over the course of time, because Scream had multiple releases on Discord, and so we're going to get a lot of chance to talk about them. But the story starts in Bailey's Crossroads, Virginia, which is a suburb of DC in Northern Virginia. And I am going to immediately take a little tangent here, because any excuse for a little American geography and history, and I'm going to jump on it. So, do you know where the name Bailey's Crossroads comes from?
Oh man. Wow. No. And I was chomping at the bit to jump in too, and 'cause I was just a mile or not a mile, but about 2 or 3 miles away from where I grew up, Bailey's Crossroads. But no, where's the name from?
Okay, well, you're gonna love this. You're gonna love it. So, the Bailey in Bailey's Crossroads comes from Hekaliah Bailey.
Of course. No, who's that?
Hekaliah, you don't Hekaliah Bailey. So many of them. Well, Hekaliah Bailey lived in the late 1700s to the early 1800s, and he was the founder of one of America's earliest circuses. And he was a role model to a young P.T. Barnum. And P.T. Barnum partnered with James Anthony Bailey, who was an orphan, but he had been adopted by Hekaliah Bailey's nephew, Frederick Harrison Bailey, who was a circus advertising advanceman. And James Anthony Bailey took the Bailey last name from his adoptive father. He partnered with P.T. Barnum, and that is the Bailey of Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Interesting.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's where that's the Bailey and Bailey's Crossroads come from. So Franz Stahl, Skeeter Thompson, and Ken Stack started jamming together as early as 1979, doing covers songs, punk songs, classic rock songs, some funk. In early 81, Franz's older brother Pete joined on vocals, and their first shows were just keg parties with cover rock bands and other rock bands. They began to get the attention of the DC scene through a few shows. They played the first Wilson Center show in 81, big show that I believe HR from the Bad Brains had set up. It's, I think we've mentioned this show before. It's kind of a legendary show. Bad Brains, Minor Threat.
There's like 12 bands or something crazy.
Yeah, Black Market Baby, GI, SOA, Red Sea, Void, and a few others.
I think Broken Cross, speaking of them, actually, they said that, Mark said that was their only show.
Yes, Broken Cross. Yeah, well, I have the full list. Also, a band called Law & Order, Mod Subs, and Prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
So they played that show. They played another one at Woodlawn High with that DOA. DOA was touring, and Jello Biafra accompanied them on that tour. Minor Threat, SOA, and Youth Brigade also played. And they played that show, and it was probably a bit of a bummer. Pete had said that people began to actually walk out on them because they thought they were posers. But Jello Biafra really took a liking to them and gave them some encouragement. And eventually, Ian really started to check them out. And once he started checking them out, then they were kind of accepted by the DC scene. And I read a kind of a funny quote from Fran Stahl, who compared it to getting a thumbs up from Caesar. And I think that, you know, that initial reaction to Scream, and it was probably similar with Void, who is the other band we've talked about so far, who were not from DC. They were not a part of that Georgetown clique. You know, they were outsiders. They were from the suburbs. Yeah. You know, if you look at pictures of them, you know, they didn't really dress like punks. They were almost a little more stylish in a certain sense. You know, they played cover songs, you know, and of course Scream would become a very important band in the scene, but you know, they were initially made to feel like outsiders, and there's even, you know, a song on this record that we'll get to in a little bit that I think addresses that. They went on tour before they had anything out in the summer of 82. And a big show was in Seattle, where a bunch of kids saw them who would later form bands like Mudhoney, Soundgarden, and Nirvana. But that tour was pretty successful, and that is what led Discord to releasing Still Screaming. And before that, though, there were a couple of sessions. They did a demo in July of 81. I tried to track down a copy of that demo and could not find it, but the song Ultraviolence Screamin' was on that, and that ended up being on that Fountain of Youth comp that we've mentioned a couple of times, the Bouncing Babies comp. And it's also on the CD that combines this album and this side up. It's kind of one of the two songs that they kind of stuck in between the two albums. So that came from that July 81 demo. They also did a session in New York City in 1982 at 171A Studios with Jerry Williams, who was a legendary New York City punk hardcore producer. He recorded
the Bad Brains.
Yeah, he recorded the Roar cassette. He did a lot of the early Beastie Boys. And that session was released on cassette in 2010. It was called Jerry's Free, and it was only made and available at shows that they had played. So that's pretty hard to come by. I would love to get my hands on that someday.
I didn't even know about
that.
Yeah. Wow.
And so that brings us to kind of late 82 when they were brought into Inner Ear Studio. But we'll get to that in a little bit. So I know that you have a great love for this band. So, you know, I kind of like doing these segments with people who have a certain real affection for certain bands that maybe are a little bit under the radar. I definitely don't want to call Scream under the radar by any stretch. I mean, they're a well-known band. But I know that you have a real love for them. So why don't you tell me, you know, a little bit about your history with Scream, kind of when you first discovered them and kind of what attracted you to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got a deep and abiding love for these guys. For one, they were they were located just down the road in Bailey's Crossroads. You know, that they're Virginia boys. They were kind of outsiders amongst the outsiders. Always got pegged as jocks and you know, stoner hicks or whatever, where, you know, which is just ridiculous. These guys were more punk than most of the other people that were out there wearing leather jackets and whatnot. These guys were revolutionary. They were put 100% into their music. They were so passionate and positive. That's like, you know, an articulate. All those things just blew me away. And their musicianship, you know, every show was just balls to the wall, good. And yeah, they would do shows where they would play, they would have cover shows where they played all covers. And they would do everything from, you know, The Sweet to Nugent to UK Subs to whatever, you know, Sham 69. You know, those were fun. They used to always do Magic Carpet Ride and jam out on it. It was good, though. But anyway, they, you know, their shows were always so good. And it always, in DC anyway, it always surprised me, because some shows they would play would be completely, you know, packed in and people just singing along and digging it. And then there'd be other shows in DC where I was one of maybe 15, 20 people in the crowd. I'm like, what? You know, what is this about? I think it just, I don't know. I don't know why that is, but that would happen. And I was going to say it later in the episode during the thing about Amerirockers, but maybe since you're asking about my experiences, first time I saw them was at a Rock Against Reagan. So I want to say 83, could have been 84, but I think it was 83. And I was just walking in up to where the bands were playing. You know, it was Rock Against Reagan. It was a big outdoor festival right down at the Capitol every year. And pretty sure like Reagan Youth played that year, a bunch of people. And I walk up as Scream's playing, and they're playing Amerirockers. And there's HR on stage with them, and he's, you know, they're doing this extended reggae stuff. And, you know, of course, the line, I know what HR would say, and, you know, he would do that. Then HR would do some kind of, you know, improv vocal stuff. HR up there in all camo, dreads flying everywhere. It was a really cool introduction to the band. Yeah, I don't know. These guys, just lyrically, energy-wise, everything. And they developed over the years. You know, I could have done without some of the millions of hammer-ons and pinched octaves they did in some of the later stuff. But, you know, their songs were always solid. They always played their hearts out live. And I bought this record at Penguin Feathers, a local record store, pretty much right after it came out. I didn't know that at the time, but I saw it and was like, who are these guys? These guys are local, and this looks like something I'd be into. And yeah, when I pulled it out and saw the Bailey Crossroads insignia they made on the center sticker, I was like, more, you know, even more into it. But yeah, that's a handful of impressions. We'll get into more.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I was a little bit late to Scream compared to some of the other bands. I did get to see them. I'm not sure. I was probably in the early 2010s. They played the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn with you know, the original four, and they were great. I mean, it was well attended. They played a ton of stuff from this album.
Did they have the second guitarist with them, or just the four?
I don't think so. I think it was just friends. I could be wrong about that, but I thought it was just the four of them.
Okay.
But I agree, you know, this is the record that I am most familiar with. So, again, I've said it a bunch of times, and one thing that I'm really looking forward to doing with this podcast is really digging deep into a lot of these bands and these records I kind of am more aware of than I am actually familiar with.
Sure.
But this album, you know, I am familiar with this album and I love it. And it's, you know, we'll talk about the album more in detail, but just generally speaking about Scream, you know, I think it's clear that like Void, they were not a part of that Georgetown clique cauldron of people. You know, they were outside. They were a little bit older, right? I think that whereas like, you know, you were talking last week about Dante being basically 14 when Iron Cross started. I mean, I think that the guys in Scream, by the time they recorded their first album, were already either in their very late teens or even early 20s by this point.
Yeah.
I think there's even a lyric in one of the songs about how, you know, they're kids of the 60s. So, so, you know, they grew up with, like, the bands you mentioned. I mean, they grew up with Hendrix. They grew up with, you know, Steppenwolf or Nugent or any of those bands. I mean, Ian and Henry have also talked about a love for Nugent.
Yeah.
You know, they were probably very aware of, you know, the Sex Pistols in 77. You know, they were already of age. They could, you know, they probably played better than any of the bands that we've discussed so far at this point. And I think that definitely comes through right out of the gate that this was a band that was a little bit different than the other bands that we've seen so far on Discord.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and mixing those influences, you know, clearly influenced by more than just punk or hardcore. I mean, clearly their influences...
They go back more than a few years.
Absolutely, like right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of music that's really, you know, they've already learned and sort of processed. I mean, I think back to myself where I was 20 and 21. I mean, you know, already, you know, basically graduating college, and my record collection was already huge compared to where I was, you know, when I was 14. I mean, you know, when you're in your 40s, when you're old men like us, a six-year age difference is nothing. But the difference between 14 and 20 or 15 and 21 is mammoth.
Yeah, it's dog years, yeah.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so I'm looking forward to really discovering the Scream catalog, and I'm looking forward to getting into this record because I think it's an absolute masterpiece.
It is, and I'm stoked to take that ride with you, man, and I love this record, and it's hard to stand up records, a band's catalog next to each other because everybody's always at a different point. A band's always at a different point at different times of development, of interest, of intensity, of all that, you know. But this album is a lot of people's favorite Scream album. It's hard for me to say it's not because it's so, so good. But the one that we get to next with This Side Up is a stone classic, whereas this is five stars still, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think the general consensus is that this and This Side Up, it's sort of a toss up of what's the better record, with maybe a slight lean towards Still Screaming, which is why I personally am looking forward to getting into all those later records, because hopefully maybe we'll see whether or not, you know, it's all justified, you know, and all that. But we'll get to that down the road. So.
Definitely. And there's some gems on the later records. Some of their best songs are on the later records. And yeah, I mean, as far as consistency and just vision and execution, that's what I mean as far as these first two. Yeah, and before we jump into putting the needle down, I just got one quote from Pete from an interview he did with Fear and Loathing Fanzine, where he kind of lays out a little bit of their influence. So Pete says, "Our background, it included everything from rock to soul and funk, garage bands to pop, you know, everything. So we just played what we liked, and our music was always a product of what we liked. We were inspired by different artists, whether it be the Bad Brains, Parliament Funkadelic, or Johnny Cash. The thing is, particularly as you get older, you realize it's just good music, regardless of what it is or where it came from. There's a lot of shit out there, so if you find something that sounds great, enjoy it. So we would bring all these different things into our music, even though the first songs we ever learned were Tell Us the Truth by Sham 69, Total War by The Lurkers, and All Around the World by The Jam. That was how we cut our teeth. We learned how to play those songs, then started to write these really basic things on our own. I think even at the very beginning, we always really wanted to be doing our own thing. In fact, there was a whole series of songs we wrote around that time, which never came out. We wrote them while we were still learning to play. So when we began to get a bit better and a bit faster, we ditched them. I wish now we had recordings of that stuff, but I don't think we ever taped them. I think that's a good kind of capstone for the history section. And, you know, also kind of gives you a little peek through the door of what they were working with as far as, you know, their development, their interest, all that.
Yeah, for sure.
So I am still, you know, flagellating myself daily over the fact that I did a really, really in-depth, really good, I thought, interview conversation with Pete, with the singer Pete Stahl, well, just over a month ago. And that was going to be the feature of this episode. He really went in deep, talked about so many things, filled in a lot of gaps for me. And yeah, I've heard other podcasters say the same thing, so I don't feel as bad, but I still do, because there's not many Pete interviews out there. And what happened was, I did it on Skype. They only keep their recordings there for 30 days. Day 32, I went to it. Boom, gone. So, yeah, no, it was great being able to talk to him, and I'm sorry I can't share that with you guys. Maybe we'll get him back for This Side Up episode, or on down the road at one of the other Scream releases. Let's just hope, because he's a very, he's a smart, soulful guy, so.
Yeah, Luxon, I mean, you know, we're still new at this, and we're going to make mistakes. You know, we're going to say things that aren't always going to be correct. I mean, I listen to plenty of podcasts where you just want to, you know, you want to shout at the announcers and be like, oh, you fucked that up. But that also applies to sort of the technological aspects of this too. And you know what? You live and you learn. And, you know, I didn't get a chance to speak to him, but, you know, I appreciate that Pete took time. And, you know, it's a bummer that it was lost. We have a lot of Scream releases to deal with. And, you know, I'm hoping that he'll indulge us with another interview down the line so we can get him on. So, listen, it happens, and, you know, we live and we learn and we move on.
Yeah. I still feel like shit, but, you know, thanks for saying that. And, you know, the silver line is we did get to talk to Enoch. We got to talk to Skeeter, so, as well as Bobby Madden, who's got some real insight and kind of was an adjunct member for a while there playing keyboards with the band. So we've got that. I think we got a good episode regardless.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. We should get into it.
Let's do it. And surprise of surprises, we were actually able to get Pete to come back and do another interview. So please welcome Pete Stahl. We don't know what it's like to not be free. That community just like jokes. That's why a chance and nothing to lose. One chance when you lose. You know what this song's about? It's a little story. I'm going to make out. It's all a dead day. But to us, it's just what they lose. Yeah, to you. Yeah.
hood. That was a neighborhood, Bailey's Crossroads. And
yeah.
And then, you know, our friends that lived in the neighborhood too, we would, I mean, we had a party at one of the Scream houses in the basement, but we never really wanted to attract attention to the house because it already got enough attention.
Cops right, without the music and shit.
Yeah, Fairfax County Police coming by, turn that shit down.
Like I said in that last one, last time we talked, that got erased.
Oh yeah, that's right. We did this before. Deja vu.
And I say that on the rest cool. of the part of the show, man. I'm like, man. anyway, man, Fairfax County Police. When I heard that on your record, I was like, oh hell yeah, these are like right down the road, guys.
That's right. Man, that was our look. That's where we incubated. You know, it wasn't originally Franz and I grew up in Arlington down the road, just straight down Columbia Pike mm-hmm. a bit. Skeeter grew up in Spring Hill right off of Columbia Pike too. And Kent and his family lived over closer to more up Route 7 a little bit. But then after when he got his first apartment, it was right up off of Columbia Pike as well. So, I mean, that street's always been integral to Arlington, you know, because it goes right down to the
right through, yeah,
right to the bridges and right past the Pentagon. And I had a paper route on there and a home paper route and commercial, that I got from I picked up through Richard Moore.
Yeah, I might be talking to him for the 00 episode coming up. Yeah,
yeah, no, me and him became really good friends, and then I started working with him and got, you know, everyone was working for the Post back, not everyone, but a bunch of us got gigs, and it was a good paying job, actually. I really enjoyed it. And actually, hey, you know, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, like, I remember hearing back in the day that you were working for the Post, mm-hmm. and then I didn't know, though, who was this? Skeeter was talking about how the restaurant that you, was it Joe Theismann? What was it?
Yeah. Glad you brought that up. Bailey's Crossroads was his first location. And, you know, I'd kind of been in boarding school a bunch, and I went to Jeb Stuart for my last year to get my high school diploma. And then that last year, I got a work release so I could get out of school early, and I started working at Theismann's. And that job kind of, you know, I was able to save up money and get my first car and get our first van, actually.
Oh, nice.
I bought through someone that worked there. Old Dodge, the 318 in it, the smaller one, which we ended up taking to the West Coast, our first tour. Bailey's Crossroads, and Franz worked there too. And
yeah,
I worked there for like, I had that job for a while, and I worked my way up eventually being a manager of the location over in Oxon Hill. Is actually close to where the Bad Brains guys lived at, because HR came there and visited me before, just hung out while I'd be working. But right. It was a trippy job.
And you got a Skeeter job there too? So like,
yeah,
three,
I think,
guys?
I did. I mean, yeah, you know, we all were like working there. And I mean, the cool thing about it is there was this really killer chef that worked there that is such a weird story. He actually had known my dad back in the day too, which I didn't find out after I started working there. But he was quite a character. and he taught me how to cook and a bunch of guys. And a lot of the dudes went on to be really successful restaurateurs and entrepreneurs. And I was on my way, really. Like I said, I was a manager of this Theismann's, and he was expanding. And by now he was like, you know, starting quarterback and everything, because he was just third string quarterback behind Billy and Sonny when I started. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. And then when we got that, we just, you know, the band happened while I was there, you know, and the money I made from that job helped us get it going. And mm-hmm. then when we went on the road, I never went back.
You know, we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but that's totally cool. Did you go on tour? Did you guys go on tour right away, like once you recorded Still Screaming?
No, we went on tour before we did Still Screaming.
Even before? Without a record, huh?
Yep. We were kind of gung-ho and determined, and that's, you know, it's what we wanted to be, was a band, touring around and being gypsies. And I mean, we had a bunch of music, And so we were already kind of on our second, like, go round of songs, you know, that we first started playing. We wrote a bunch of songs. And then...
would, like, Ultraviolence Still Screaming be in those?
They would be eventually, yeah. American Justice too. There was other songs that we didn't end up ever recording, like the song called It Ain't Right, which was definitely about Fairfax County Police busting our parties up all the time. And this song called Brainwash, which, I mean, I wish we had this whole, like, they were a lot slower, not so influenced, you know, or inspired by, you know, seeing when we finally saw, when I finally saw the Bad Brains, and we started like, well, we want to play Tats too. And then
kind of
tilted us in a different direction musically. And
it had to be hard to, for any, I mean, it sounds, talking to all the bands, it's got to be, I can't imagine, like, seeing the Bad Brains and not, like, being incredibly influenced by them.
Yeah. And, you know, the way we approached music too was also, you know, because we were all kind of come from a stoner jock kind of background. Uh-huh. And, you know, we kind of came at musically athletically too. We wanted to be as tight as them, you know, and just like, and be as fast as them. And, you know, there were that, you know, a lot of bands and a lot of people were aspired to that, because those guys were ferocious. And probably, you know, if you saw them back in the day, best band you probably ever saw in your life.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't see them till they moved away and came back the first time. But even still, there's a couple of those shows.
Oh, yeah.
They still had it.
No doubt. So you were asking me about Five Minutes. And yeah, that job.
Your incubation center.
Yeah. And those jobs were integral to giving me the money to be able to get a van and kind of, you know, be able to get the houses going so we could rehearse and everything. And yeah, so we had those Scream houses that were all around that Bailey's Crossroads. And I wanted to get back to that because there was people that had found the hoops from the elephants and stuff in the backyards of those houses around in that area from the Barnum and Bailey Circus, because they used to keep the animals there that in the off season. Yeah. Those houses were great. I mean, I was renting a house there for like $400 a month, and it would have, like, you know, 5-6 bedrooms and a basement, which is what we needed. And then down the street from there, down Bailey's Crossroads in Arlington, where Franz and I grew up. Well, first we grew up in a, like, you know, these old apartment buildings, garden apartments at Arlington Village. And then just up the street, and I went to Patrick Henry and TJ, so did Franz. And then right behind TJ was Ivy Street, and that's where we moved to second. And turned out we went from a time when I was, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, till about 16, 17. We were living there off of Ivy Street before my mom remarried, and we were actually just living a couple doors down from where Don Zantara's studio ended.
I was going to say, yeah, Ivy Street.
Yeah, so it was so weird, just to segue into Still Screaming. When we did that record, the duplex was the exact same configuration as our duplex, and, you know, everything was the same, going down to the basement and everything, so... And because that studio was really, you know, tiny and perfect.
Yeah.
It was a perfect place to record.
Yeah, it was comfortable.
One of those classic, like, you know, famous studios or seminal studios that you know, whether it be, I don't know if you ever had an opportunity to take the tour at Motown. It's the same thing. It's a house, even though that was like a whole thing.
No, I never checked them out.
Tour.
I've been to the Stax one, but.
Yeah, you know, they were all started in houses, basically. Yeah, so it was, Don's was no different, except it never turned into a label, but it was, you know, this cool little place. And that's the first place we recorded, and it turned it out, you know, ended up just being just down the street from our house where we grew up. So it was really cool.
Yeah, that had to be both, for you guys, both surreal and super comfortable to, like, walk into this place that... was exactly,
yeah,
because, like,
I mean, in our duplex up the street, I had the basement when I was growing up. So that's where we would go down and party. And I discovered a lot of music in that basement, a lot of other things, too.
Sure.
But, yeah, it was in that way. You're right. So it was, like, it was surreal, but it also felt comfortable. It's a good description.
Yeah, man. And And so, like, you had mentioned before, like, and Skeeter, like, briefly mentioned too, like, how, you know, how your pops was in the music business and,
yeah, that was,
you know.
That's kind of what planted the seed for Franz and I. It was sown from my dad's dabbling as a manager for rock bands in the Washington, D.C. area. He was a civil rights attorney and then got into, you know, kind of managing bands through the law aspect. I guess some band, you know, I don't know exactly if they come to him to look at a contract, but he got into that and started managing this band called The Hangman, which was a really cool band and, you know, had a big influence on Franz and I. I mean, I was 10 years old, Franz was 8, and my dad, you know, my parents were separated at the time, and he would come by and pick us up on weekends and take us to the Rabbit's Foot, which was this little club up on Wisconsin Avenue. And we used to go see the Hangman play, and you know, the girls would give me notes to give to the band, and you know, say, yeah, I want to be in a band. And then they you know, they played all over the area. They had like a regional hit, What a Girl Can't Do, which the Slicky Boys ended up covering. It's a great song. They had a lot of cool songs. They put out basically a few singles and one album on Monument.
Do you still have those?
Oh, hell yeah. I got singles and I got the record. Yeah, that's for sure. And they also played the church that Franz and I went to when, you know, we grew up in, which is this church in Green Valley in Southern Arlington called Our Lady Queen of Peace, which is still going. It's a great church. Does a lot of community stuff. And it was a big influence on my life, being at that church, being a part of it, participating in that church. And but Hangman played there too a few times, and which for some reason the night that they played it has a big, I just, you know, I really vividly remember them playing and then going out and hanging out back with them between sets when they're smoking. And Bobby Berkrick, the drummer, he was really cool, still kicking it. He's got a record store.
Oh, nice.
In Maryland, him and his wife, Martha Hull. And I think it's called Forbidden Acres, if I'm not mistaken. Check it out. I mean, we just looked up to these guys. Like, they were all like cool rock band, 1968, I guess this was, something like that. I remember Bobby gave me a ride on the back of his motorcycle at his house one time. And also,
you had some really good influences for being that young.
Yeah, I was really lucky to see that, and also seeing the, you know, feeling and seeing the DIY attitude, because, you know, they were making flyers and doing stuff themselves. I felt that, and there was a community, a sense of community with them. I remember hanging at their house up somewhere in Georgetown one time and just feeling this really great vibe, you know, of a community of people making music and doing stuff.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And so, you know, not to paint with too broad a brush here, but, like, you know, it's interesting then, like, with your dad being into civil rights stuff and being a rock manager, and then, like, you know, you kind of followed in his footsteps in many ways, huh?
Yeah, it's funny how that happens, you know. You don't but you see, he was smarter than I. He already had his law degree. So once rock and roll was done with him,
he still had the law.
Yeah. And he ended up being a judge for the city of New York and did quite well for himself.
Oh,
I talked to him today, thankfully.
Oh, cool. That's good. Yeah, he's still kicking then, huh?
Yeah. He's going to be 88.
Franz and Skeeter were like playing together before you joined up with them?
Yeah, I'm glad you got a chance to talk to Skeeter, because it's really, I know you're, I think I saw that this podcast is, you're playing it tomorrow night. So
Yeah,
you should come back and talk to Kent Stack sometime too, if you can get him on the phone.
Oh, definitely.
It's always good to get, because, you know,
everybody's perspective.
Totally, because, you know, all through our careers, band, you know, I always end up getting the questions and doing all the talking and hogging the interviews. But really, Skeeter and Kent and Franz have their own perspectives. And
Well, and all you guys brought so, you know, you take one of the elements out and it's a whole different thing. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They, like I was saying, that, I'd been away at boarding school. I'd kind of gone back and forth between public school and boarding school through my junior high and early high school years. And, I learned how to play guitar and, you know, and kind of showed Fran some stuff. And then he took it from there and went to another level. And then I, while I was away, him and he had met Skeeter, and they'd actually started playing and formed, you know, playing with people in Bailey's Crossroads. I don't know if Skeeter.
Yeah, he kind of told, I
think the guy's name was Jim Pastel or something like that.
Oh, he said a different name, but yeah. Oh,
okay, well, he would know. I mean, I just kind of vaguely remember this. And then, and then, like I said, I came back from boarding school and to graduate from Stewart in my last year. And so those guys already had some experience in kind of playing and
building up a musical connection already.
Yeah. And then somewhere along the line, they asked me to sing for them, or I just kind of, I don't know, butted my way in there. I don't think so. I think they just asked me, and originally we were playing with this guy, Steve Erm, I think his name was. Uh-huh. And then I was working at JT's, and I, you know, Kent went to school with Franz and Skeet, and then, you know, then we all started playing together and writing. So it's kind of, that happened.
And so, like, was that show at Wilson Center, the big first Wilson Center show, was that your first DC show?
Well, no. I mean, we had been, as far as maybe in the punk scene or kind of hardcore scene that was happening, maybe yes. But I think Bad Brains got us our first show at the Wilson Center. But we had been playing, like, some of the other, like, Posers and Scandals and I forget the names of those, but we have been playing some of the new wave kind of punk clubs that were in Georgetown and up going into DC, but it was, you know, it was kind of, we had gotten into those through another, you know, just by submitting demo and through this band called the Layman. It was some friends of ours, and actually Jefferson Rogers was the bass player in that band. He recorded our first demo, and that first demo was it in your ear as well. So, which I forgot to mention earlier that, you know, doing Still Screaming there was actually the second time we had recorded it in your ear. Oh. So, but the first time was with Jefferson Rogers.
Right. Huh. So, okay. And then,
and Don was there too, of course, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's always there.
but the Layman were this cool new wave band. You know, there was this great scene happening in DC.
Yeah, more art, arty new wave stuff.
Yeah, right? always interesting musical town. Like I was saying, but there was also this band, The Deceits. They had Keith Campbell, who ended up starting a Black Market Baby or being in Black Market Baby. Uh-huh. And Martha Hull was a singer in that band. And like I was mentioned earlier, strangely enough, she married Bobby Berkwick, the drummer from The Hangman, who also played in Grin with Nils Lofgren.
Oh, but he played in Nils Lofgren's band? Wow.
Yep. But yeah, Martha was a singer in The Seats. Really cool band. Really, if you can find any of their music or records, check it out. And then, of course, there was the Raz, which was the band.
Yeah.
Huge influence on me and Franz and Skeet, because I had ran into them at some club in Falls Church, and you know, they were one of those bands, like all the bands that were working the clubs to do four sets a night, and they would sprinkle a bunch of covers in with their originals in each set, which is kind of how we kind of started working our stuff too.
When
we started writing, you know, we were playing a bunch of covers, and that which helped us shape our musical style, mostly a lot of British punk and garage music, like you know, from the Hangman's era and all that stuff. And then we learned how to write our own songs. So
that's cool. So, like, what would the process be like of you guys putting a song together?
I mean, it's not that much has changed in that way. I mean, in some way, because we would get together at rehearsal. And just start jamming and just kind of improvise and come up, start shaping an idea, you know, kind of like a piece of clay, you know, on a potter's wheel, you know, it's just like a blob that you kind of mold and shape into a song.
Right. You start seeing more details in it and all that.
And then, you know, I might just shout gibberish and then write the song afterwards lyrically and come back and match the gibberish with phonetically with words. And, you know, we just make a song up, but and kind of still do that same kind of process, even though this past, you know, with this whole COVID thing, we've, Fonz and I have been trading a lot of stuff via, you know, the internet. And I'll go sing by myself somewhere in this rehearsal room I got access to and then send it back to them. But yeah, I mean, and everyone had input. Even, you know, Kent would write stuff and Skeeter, you know, it's definitely a collaborative mishmash that would come together and make a song.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you like that's one thing that shows right from the start on Still Screaming, even like in all three of you guys, you can see the progression for sure and vision. But like right away, even on Still Screaming, you guys are you're not playing verse chorus. You've got like a lot of structure to the songs, a lot of dynamics. You've got the layered backups. That's like a thing that was like really unique to you guys at that point, at least in DC.
I mean, thanks for saying that. I mean, I feel like our stuff was always pretty, you know, pretty basic in some ways, but the vocal stuff kind of developed as Skeeter always liked to sing, and then when we did Still Screaming, I mean, Ian and you know, had a big influence on. We would also do gang vocals and stuff, you know. So he helped us, you know, in his role as, you know, kind of producing was very helpful, you know, with that. And then also like a lot of the, you said, layering, you know, sound effects and things like that. Him and Don, like Laissez Faire, you know, like the acoustic stuff and then kind of the electric stuff. That's production stuff that, you know, kind of the flavor that they brought to it.
Yeah, which is wild, man. Like, people wouldn't guess that because, you know, when people think of Ian, especially back then, they wouldn't think acoustic guitars and all that. And you guys were trying to play fast, you know, influenced by Bad Brain and stuff like that. Were you hesitant about doing the acoustic, or were you like, just like, yeah, let's try it?
Not at all. I mean, I can't really, you know, it's hard to remember how that all came about. You know, we were so excited to be in a studio doing an album. I mean, you know, Don was great to work with and Ian was great to work with. And I think it, you know, the way they would maybe propose things or whatnot, you know, and I think maybe, you know, the acoustic guitar was probably just lying around, you know, and like I don't know if, you know, if some of your other interviews have told you that the basement that Don had, it was, you know, it's like the kids' room, you know?
Yeah, all the stuffed animals and things.
Exactly,
yeah.
And so it was very cozy that way, and a lot of instruments and things, like cowbell, like I think that, you know, maybe the cowbell and Piece of Your Time is probably just laying around, and, you know, stuff just gets picked up and start making noise.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, and the session was really fast. I think we did it like 3 days, 21 songs, but, you know, it's a lot of goofing off, too, so... A lot of that stuff came about from goofing off, and I think you can hear that.
Yeah,
in a lot of the in between, you know,
the pattern and stuff. Yeah,
and so.
Yeah, definitely. So, like lyrically, on your lyrics on there, and in general, you know, one thing I always got was just such a, besides the sincerity, that it was very conscious, and also, you know, there's some angry energy, like rebellion, but it was like also. Couched in a very PMA style attitude, you always had this optimistic type of slant to the lyrics, even the ones that were about, you know, injustice and stuff. There's this sense of like let's do something about it, not just just bitch, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, you know, basically the lyrics for Still Screaming kind of was our mantra, and, you know, what I say is what I say, what, you know, what I want is what I want. What I want to say is I want to get through to you, you know? So we were definitely all about communicating our thoughts and ideas and emotions through our music and to people and, you know, make movement through groovement, you know? So, and, you know, that still kind of runs through all our records from this side up, you know, and
right.
what you say, PMA, positive mental attitude and being optimistic. I mean, we're still out there now screaming the blues. And so one of the ways to get through the blues is to scream at it and find ways to get through it. And so
right.
that's what we did then. And that's what we do now when we get, you know, we don't unfortunately get a chance to get together that often. And we were shut down this summer.
I know you're supposed to go to Europe, right?
Yep. Yeah. We should be going there in a few weeks.
Oh man.
Yeah, but anyway,
get back. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think we had this discussion before, you know, I was a little bit older than Franz and Skeet and, you know, been to boarding school and, you know, growing up in the DC area, you're kind of in and around politics, you know, and
true.
I was always interested in it. My parents were involved with the Democratic Party and I was interested in what was going on around me and wanted to write about it, you know? And so we had a lot of fun songs about our, you know, youth and growing up and girls and all that stuff, like hygiene and Piece of Your Time and things like that. But then, you know, we had other songs like American Justice, a song about getting, you know, kind of fucked over by the cops, you know, and it's a true story happened to me and just kind of telling the story and then kind of, especially early on, learning how to tell a story, which is something kind of did with this band and to relay the story and kind of make it, you know, mean something more than just their own personal kind of what happened to me, you know?
Sure. Make it universal, even though it's your story.
Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, we covered a gamut with all our songs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like you had one exactly. You would sing about all aspects of your life, which also made it more relatable, you know.
I hope so.
Yeah, at least to me. Yeah, definitely, you know. Like specifically something like Solidarity, like what was the
I mean obviously that happened. We wrote that song during the Solidarity movement that had kind of kicked up in Poland around the fall of communism. And so that story had, you know, impacted me and wanted to write about it. So that's where that song came from. And then of course you can kind of take it anywhere you want with that, as far as like,
and you've played Poland, right?
Scream never played Poland.
Oh,
no,
okay.
Unfortunately not. We did make it as far as we did get a chance to get to Yugoslavia before the wall came down and the country split up in all the different provinces, but we never made it to Poland, unfortunately. Haven't.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've been there since then with other bands working, but no, I haven't personally played there yet.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's where the nut of that song came from, that movement.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking. I just wanted to ask about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so did you guys feel? Because, I don't know, it's weird. It seems like you guys had a dynamic, and maybe it was placed at you more than what you actually felt, or placed on you more than what you felt, of, you know, the kind of out, not quite fitting in, being the Virginia guys, like, you know, you're embraced into the scene, but you're also kind of not exactly fully pulled in.
Yeah, well, that I mean, there's... We always tell that story and you know, kind of wear it on our sleeves, so to speak. Uh-huh. But there's definitely some truth in it. But in the sense that, you know, like I said, we went on tour by ourselves before we made our first record, and we had just been playing like keg parties and small clubs around town. And then I'm not I don't think that that I think the Wilson Center show came later that you were referring to.
Oh,
but
okay. Uh-huh.
When we went on tour and we came back, I do remember we were playing this show at the Mill. It's like it was called the Mill or something like that. I think it was in Maryland, if I'm not mistaken. And at that show, Ian asked us if we'd record Still Screaming. So then once we got invited to do that record for them, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of opened up the doors right. for us as being part of that scene, which is what we really wanted to be a part of. And so, but yeah, I mean, you know, the beginning of that hardcore scene was just, it was really small. We had our own little thing happen in a Bailey's Crossroads, Arlington mm-hmm. area. And, you know, DC hardcore punk thing, you know, was in Georgetown, centered around that and Wilson High School and all that. So, but you know, we kind of wanted to be a part of that scene because we liked those bands, and you know.
Yeah, vibe. Yeah. Well, yeah, and you had like a lot of things in common with them. So, yeah, I just, you know, I'd heard about the early days, and then also, you know, going to shows throughout the mid and late '80s, seeing you guys. There's, it's like, you know, I could feel both things, being within the crowd even, you know.
Yeah. It was weird. Well, I mean, that's part of being, you know, being in a scene and everyone's still like come in their late teens and mm-hmm, early 20s, mm-hmm. so true. Everybody's there's a lot of testosterone going on.
Well, yeah, that's
there's a lot of stuff going on. It's funny because I recently came across a practice tape, and I wish I had more practice uh-huh. tapes. And it's we're in the basement just going through our set, and one of our buddies, this guy Greg Miller, uh-huh. Who I'm, you know, rest in peace, no longer with us, and he actually wrote part of Fight too, and we're all hanging out because, you know, we're at the Scream houses, people come over and hang out, and you know, everyone would kind of hang out, drink beer, and we practice, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would practice like 3-4 nights a week, but I did come across this practice tape where we're all talking about it. Some show that had happened a couple nights before, and he was talking about being in the pit, and you know, there's, you know, people were like fucking with him because he wasn't from there, you know, we're from Virginia or whatnot, you know, and it's just mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. And we're just like we sound like we're 15 years old or something. I mean, I think I had to have been like 20 and those guys were probably 18, but it's just so
well, but
funny to listen to it. It's really cute.
Well, yeah, I mean, and
we sound like there's a bunch of little kids, man.
Well, a lot of those early hardcore bands, like at that time, the early '80s,
everybody sound like a bunch of knuckleheads. Is what it sounds like, because like everyone's interrupting each other, everyone's talking shit, and then we like launch into a song, fuck it up. I'm thinking I want to put some of that on the next record. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, totally, man. And well, but so the thing to me, like, there's lots of bands back then doing songs about fighting and all that, but like, what I liked re-listening to the record recently to do this is, you know, you take it from a kind of testosterone level to a higher level about fighting for your rights, fighting for justice and stuff, not just for to prove yep. you're tougher than the other guy.
Mm-hmm. There you go, man.
So, like, oh, so from back, you know, it's obviously a long ways away from those days, but like,
yeah, it's like going on
close to 40.
It's been close to 40 years. Yeah, it's crazy.
It is, man. So what do you think you carry with you still, like that the seed was planted back then? Like what about it?
Well, I mean, that experience shaped my life as far as being, you know, I'd been in bands and a musician, and been very fortunate with where I've ended up, you know, and what I've been able to experience. But I guess that experience of forming a band with my brothers and traveling around the world together, and having all these experiences and making family and friends all over the world and sharing mm-hmm. ideas, sharing music. I mean, we're so lucky to have been able to do that. And I've kind of been very fortunate to be able to continue to kind of be that gypsy and still kind of do that, you know, and mm-hmm. work for other artists, kind of showing them around. Like, well, yeah, this, they've already been there.
Showing the ropes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then it also still gives me the flexibility to play music with other bands I'm in, mm-hmm. thankfully. And then, you know, every now and then Scream can get together. But I mean, like, those songs still ring true to me, even though some of them are kind of silly. and I still sing them and still feel like they're relevant today.
And, yeah, in some ways, they're more than they have been in a long time.
I'm proud of everything that we've done and continue to do. So,
definitely, man. You got a, it's a legacy to be proud of. You know, I wouldn't be doing this podcast. People wouldn't, like, Bobby wouldn't be writing a book, all that, if this stuff wasn't important, if it didn't make a difference in people's lives back then and, you know, hopefully today.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, man.
Oh, absolutely. And what keeps you, I mean, you kind of just answered it. Whoa.
Sorry.
You kind of just answered it, but, like, what keeps you hungry to, like, still want to get out there, like, you know, with Scream and the other bands, like, what is
well,
it that
still got,
drives
still got,
you?
Still got songs to sing, still got stories to tell, still got a lot to learn, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it keeps me going, you know? Mm-hmm. It's and like you said, gives me that PMA, keeps uh-huh. me optimistic,
yeah,
you know?
That's
and
good. And it's cool
me,
that
helps
you're...
me, helps me, helps me guide my way, you know, and helps me make good decisions and helps me discover mm-hmm. new music.
Right. New music, you know? new connect to people, all that, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, my whole journey has been through that band and then, you know, branching off and going into other bands and then coming back and then all the people I've collaborated with and all the people I've met and friends with and still create with to this yeah. day, you know, so
definitely
I guess you asked me what do I take with me, it's just like everything. I got everything in a big old sack on my back,
right?
And, you know, still
it's your fuel
got,
too, huh?
Still got everything in boxes from when I left Bailey's Crossroads and up out here in LA, so still got stuff in storage and, you know, still kind of moving.
Yeah, that's what's cool is like people like you guys are like you're still in touch with your roots. You're still like, you know, for whatever bad analogy you want to say, you're still watering those roots, but you're like, you know, you're trying new things. You're still inspired, still screaming. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. What are you excited for next, man? What are you most excited for coming up?
Well, had a lot of downtime recently, so that's uh-huh. been great because it's afforded me the opportunity to work on music and write that I don't normally have the time to do. So, as soon as we can, we're going to record another Scream record, which, you know, and, you know, we know that and whatever audience we have whenever we play, and, you know, we're not one of the big punk bands. We're not one of the more well-known punk bands. We are Scream, Washington, D.C., and, you know, a lot of our fan base are guys in other bands, you know, and
right.
We're not like a big band, you know, and so we know when people come see us, they want to see Still Screaming. They want to see this side up or they want to hear those songs, and which is cool. But for us, for, to for me to still do it, I got to have, you know, got to sing a new song here and there.
Even if I get that.
Even if we ain't had a chance to record it. So last time we got together, really kind of reunited, was in 2010. And then we did that. We were fortunate enough to make that record, that EP for Complete Control for Side One Dummy. And then, you know, we've done some demos since then. Like, we did some recording out the Rancho finally, which is in Joshua Tree. But we didn't really put it out. I think we made a cassette of it. And then we have a whole collection of tunes now. We have enough material for more than an album. So as soon as we can, if we can figure it out financially, we want to go back and record with Don again. Yeah. You know, because we ain't getting any younger, and I don't want to mess about and you know, not miss out on a chance to go do another record with Franz Kent Skeet and Don Tintera. So, they can make it happen. And it will be, you know, I'm really excited about that because we got a bunch of killer songs. But, you know, we always think that.
Well, you have to. If you didn't, if you didn't think they were good, that would be a bad sign, man. That's one thing. I remember every show that I would see you guys, and I saw you.
We'd always play a new song, right?
Yeah, at least one new song. Yeah. You know, if not a couple.
So it's really important to us. But I think most musicians are really fully well aware that, you know, everybody wants to see their first record.
But
you know, all bands want to play new stuff. That's what, you know, they live for is writing and playing and, you know, like I said, telling stories.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want to tell the same story over and over.
No, you might want to tell the same, you know, same story, but just in a different way or, you know, you know. Yeah, so I'm really excited about that. And then I play in, you know, a band Earthlings, and we have a lot in. We just put out a 7-inch. I just got it in the mail yesterday.
Oh, cool.
So that just came out. And
is that the first in a little bit?
Yeah. The last record we put out, I think, was put out on an album like 2 or 3 years ago, I think. I can't remember if it was 3 or 2. And now we just put out a single, and then we'll put out another record, but another album soon, but I don't think it will be till, you know, next year, because we everybody else can't really get together right now.
Right.
So,
God, man. Yeah, you're going to be like chock full of song ideas by the time you get out.
I would imagine there will be a huge explosion of new music once people can get back to recording in a group setting. As we used to. So
much
I would expect
less shows.
A huge explosion of the arts in general, you know. So that'll be a good, you know, renaissance for everybody to be a part of and experience and hopefully move us forward.
I know, man. You know? Get us into more constructive and celebratory type of energy versus all this division and fucking, you know,
negativity. Yeah,
negativity. Definitely. Yeah,
I hear you, man. More power to you, brother.
All right, well, I don't want to keep you too long. This is the second time we did this, so
thank you very much, and I'm glad that we got it wrapped up. And make sure you press save or whatever you do. And,
absolutely. If
you go back and you're editing and you need anything clarified, don't hesitate to give me a holler. I'll be around all day tomorrow. And, you know, I hope you get a chance to talk to Kent and Franz for this side up. And I'm more than happy to rap with you again, Brian, and good luck with your podcast. I listened to a couple of them, and you're doing a good job. And thanks a lot.
Man. Yeah, I mean, it's not a entertainment thing, man. It's something that I felt compelled to do. And, you know, I play music too, but I can't do that right now either. So this is perfect. It's something.
All right. Well, if you have that filter button that makes us sound really smart, make sure you push that.
I broke it, man. All right.
Yeah, but probably from using it so much.
Yeah, right. Jeff, well, I'm dying to drop the needle on this one.
Definitely, I am definitely ready to drop the needle on this one.
Cool.
Okay, so Discord number 9, the debut album by Scream, still screaming. The first bona fide Discord full length LP, at least one that's by a single band. It was recorded in October of 82 at Inner Ear Studio. Produced by Ian MacKay, Eddie Janney, and Don Zientara. It was released in January of 83. There have been tons of represses of this record over the years. The first press was 3,500, and you know you own it if it has a brown center label and heavy cardstock cover, and there's no, like, you know, made in the UK or whatever on the back cover. If you have that, then you have an original pressing. The represses, almost all the represses had a yellow label instead of the brown label. The second press says made in the UK on the back. The third press says made in France. I actually have, I think it's the 2009 white vinyl remastered reissue repress, and mine has the yellow label, but there were some with the white vinyl that did revert back to the original brown label. But pretty much all the represses, except for that one repress, pretty much have the yellow labels on it. So this is it's a powerhouse. It's an incredible record. I can't wait to start discussing it with you. So I'm gonna throw it over to you. Let's get going.
Yeah, let's dive into side one. So first thing you hear is that high-pitched sound that, to me, sounds like a imminent attack, a bomb about to go off, and that's what happens. It's Came Without a Warning, and perfect intro to the record. They just dive right in and are, like, so on fire right from the very first. You know, I saw somewhere that Fletcher from Pennywise told Skeeter that song was one of the first couple songs that inspired him to start a band, to start Pennywise. And, you know, I don't love Pennywise, but that's cool to hear. And in that first little intro drum break, man, Kent's on fire. He is so on it. Like, that's one thing that listening back to this record I didn't catch in the beginning, was just how good of a drummer Kent Stax is. He is just so precise. He's like he sounds like, he's got a very martial style, but he sounds to me like a less hyper, less flashy Jeff Nelson style drummer. He's so strong. And they all, in the intro, that just the very first few handful of seconds of the song, they all have little moments. It's like they're introducing the band. Like Franz does a little guitar solo. Kent has his drum break. There's the little bass riff right before they go into the singing. It's great, man. And that's just the intro. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, no, right. I like the way you put that, that they each have their own little thing. And, you know, my notes, I did think about Ken Stockson, that drum pattern. You know, he's playing this really cool sort of syncopated bass drum pattern. I mean, it almost sounds like he's playing double bass there. I mean, he's not. Yeah. He's not. But, yeah, great drumming. And great drumming on this whole... The musicianship on this record is way ahead of the game, period. You know, and there is a certain charm to the fact that punk rock can be played by people who are kind of just starting out on their instruments. You know, like last week, we talked about the Iron Cross record, and there were good songs on there, but it's also clear mm-hmm. that these guys like kind of had just started playing.
Definitely.
But yeah. There's also something really refreshing about hearing this type of music played by guys who can really play. And, yeah, from the opening, you know, Kent's drum work, Skeeter's little bass lead, you know, his bass part that leads right into the first verse. And then, yeah, I mean, just like the lyric said, you know, it came from beyond when they dropped the bomb. And it's just, bam, you know, the song is completely in your face. I could see, you know, I do like a lot of the early Pennywise records. And I could, you know, now that you mentioned that quote from Fletcher, I can hear it. I love how, you know, they're each, there's no weak link in this band. And
no.
I feel like one of my, I think one of the strong points of this band is Pete's vocals. And,
oh, God,
you
yeah.
know, I don't know exactly who specifically is writing the lyrics on these songs, but
it's Pete.
Well, one thing that I love aside from his voice and the fact that he doesn't vocally sound the same on every song, but he is so playful with the way he writes words. He really plays with words and just how they sound, and just this song leads with that.
You're stealing my notes, my friend.
I'm gonna read the verse, I think it's like the last verse in the song, because it's so much fun, right? So but yeah, I just want to read this one verse just to sort of demonstrate how playful he is with the words he's using. You know, really, really clever. So, you were watching the Brady Bunch while your brain was out to lunch. Fast food fed on Captain Crunch. Drowned in atomic punch. Gone in an eternal munch. You didn't even have a hunch. I mean, that is so clever. It's so rhythmic. Like, just the pattern of the words is so rhythmic. And he does this throughout the course of the entire record.
Oh, yeah. And he mentions a lot of food. He talks about Big Macs, Captain Crunch. You know, it's funny, his use of imagery to encapsulate the consumerism in America at the time.
Yeah, and these lyrics actually sort of remind me a little bit of, like, Bad Brains, The Regulator. That was sort of the first song that came to mind when I was reading the lyrics. Just the idea of sort of this, you know, unknown behind the curtain, nefarious source, you know, that is, you know, that's affecting you in some ways without you even noticing it until it's too late.
Yeah, and I mean that. So this song, you know, I can't remember. You're about 4-5 years younger than me. I don't know.
I'm gonna be 47 in about 2 weeks.
Oh okay. So you're just barely 3 years younger. But yeah, I mean, when he wrote this, especially, but also when this came out, you know, the Cold War was in, you know, the height of its craziness. Like, we had those drills where you had to hide under your desk in case of a nuclear attack. It was insane. Like, kids and adults were like, had this constant background static of you know, anxiety about, you know, any day now, any moment now, something could happen where US or Russia could be like, you know, could push that button. So that's what, you know, it's hard today for kids, I'm sure, or for anyone to really have that mindset, but that was so real back then.
Yeah, I mean, we are today living in what feels like sort of an eternal tension, and you know, more than ever, you know, this sort of fear of unknown behind the curtain forces. But sure. I mean, these are great lyrics, and right, that makes sense. You always have to kind of put the perspective of the time that they're in.
Yeah, and like you said about Pete singing, you know, he, right out of the gate, just comes across the sound of his vocal delivery, everything. It's fully realized. He's got a playfulness, like you said. I'm glad you said that, because I was, you know, not just the lyrics, but even, I think, maybe because I've seen him so many times, but you can tell, like, even in the way he delivers it, there's anger, there's passion, but there's also, like, a playful energy to it. And it's just so confident and heartfelt, you know, his delivery. That's like what cemented the band for me. The playing's amazing, but Pete's delivery and lyrics are what, like, hammered everything home and kept them so important in my the development of how I really saw the world and saw potential of how to navigate growing up in a way that was defiant yet hopeful and revolutionary but not stern, you know.
Yeah. No, and you know, he's got a full-bodied voice, you know. It's not like throaty like kind of a lot of the early hardcore singers who, you know, didn't use their, you know, anyone who's a real singer knows they have to use their entire body to sing. It's not just from your head and your throat, which is kind of what you get from, you know, kids who are picking up a mic for the first time and singing some hardcore. But, you know, Pete's voice is just completely full bodied. And definitely, just, again, the way he uses words and the way he sings them, it's, you know, it's almost like rapping in a way. You know, just how rhythmic it is, just how line after line just kind of rolls off the tongue.
And yeah, there's a lot of moments like that on this record.
Absolutely, yeah. So I figured I'd present it here because this song right out of the gate really demonstrates that. And probably, you know, I mean, arguably probably the best known song on this record, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because as great of an opener as it is, it's not my favorite song on the record by any means, which I won't give away since we're going to do that, you know.
No, it's not mine. It's not mine either. But I think it might be the ideal opening song.
Yeah. Of all the songs on here, it makes sense. Absolutely.
So next up is Bedlam.
Yeah, Bedlam. You know, I know you've probably got more to say about it than I do. You know, I grew up with this whole record. Like, it's imprinted in my brain. But this song, like, to me, it was one of those songs that it was more about the energy of it and the it kept things moving, but it didn't touch me like some of the songs. And it almost feels like the band is still kind of trying to figure out their direction, their sound on this song. The playing's sharp, but they don't write a lot of songs like this as time goes on. Having said that, by the last verse, like, Pete, like, really opens up and full throttle vocally, and the music kind of like jumps up a notch, and that part really is cool to me. But anyway, you know, what'd you think?
Yeah, I dig this song. You know, again, we talked about that there is a lot of influence, different influences that are in the pot for this record. And one of
there's
several...
a lot of pot in the influence for the screen too.
Well, one of the influences is I hear a lot of early LA stuff, a lot of early LA punk, not just this song, a couple of other songs we'll get to where I really
weird. Okay.
And this song, I really hear TSOL in this. For me, this is like something that could have come from the first TSOL record that was more political. It wasn't really like the kind of horror punk that they did with Dance With Me. It was a more political record.
Right.
And just musically and lyrically, this really sounds like something that TSOL would have done in their earliest days. I mean, just even the, you know, the line on this, you know, oh, you're stabbed in the back, have a nice day. I mean, that is just something, this sort of political commentary with a real satirical, snarky sense that I think would have come out of Jack Grisham.
Yeah,
I love
that. Makes sense.
I love Skeeter's bass playing. I mean, I love, you and I are bass players, so we're always going to focus on the bass a bit. And Skeeter does not let us down throughout this record at all. His bass lines really drive so many of these songs.
Oh yeah, throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, there's a specific part I love in the song. It's about two-thirds of the way through, where Franz is just kind of like holding on to this real high chord. Skeeter is playing underneath it, and the rhythm guitar just kind of keeps doing these like dropouts. And it's just a great, cool little section, and just, you know, an evolution of songwriting, something more than just everybody just play at the same time until the song ends.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all these songs, you know, they all have different sections, they're well crafted. They're not just, okay, verse, chorus, end, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of, you know, dynamics in the songwriting, like you said, not purely conventional, you know, verse, chorus types, like you just said. And just like little moments like that where, hey, you know, if one of the, you know, he's this one guitarist, but, you know, clearly mm-hmm. multiple guitar tracks. And hey, let's just knock out one of the guitars. And it gives it this feeling of sort of openness and space for a little bit. And it just makes it that much more powerful when everybody comes back in together.
Yeah, definitely. Anything else on Bedlam?
No, I'm ready to move on. The next one, an anthem, Solidarity.
Yeah, this is one of the first songs on here that, I mean, especially back then, but even now, like, every time I hear this, I'm just a sucker for really strong melody and really good sing-alongs, and this song really is, man. It's one of the first songs in the album that's got that uplift quality. It's, you know, all about community, about, you know, again, fighting from the heart, about resistance, and it's nuanced, you know. It's such a good song. So it's the first song on here, which there's a handful that remind me of, and I grew up listening concurrently to them and, you know, a band like 7 Seconds, one of the other American most well-known bands to have those kind of really sing-along choruses and those whoa-whoa-whoas type of going on. And, you know, I feel like Scream were the more mature version of that. Like I said, the more nuanced, the more layered and depth version, which I love 7 Seconds too, but on songs like Solidarity and Stand and those kind of songs, this is just pure sing-along heaven, man. Yeah, and I love that it's got lines like, you know what this song's about. It's a love story. It's not just about things are fucked and we've got to fight. It's like, yeah, we've got to fight, but, you know, this is about loving the people that you're fighting for and having that be the center of your reason to fight, about community and all that. It's so good.
Yeah, it's great. I also, we're on the same wavelength, because I actually had in my notes whoa-oh-ohs in the backing vocals, and absolutely. I mean, it's so anthemic. Again, something that Pete does a lot on this record, where it's kind of almost like he's doing a call and response with himself, you know, where he says mm-hmm. a line and kind of sings a line back to him. And again, just being really playful with words. And in this song, actually playing with the same word. Like he says, you know, that's why one chance is nothing to lose, a chance to lose. And, you mm-hmm. know, but to us, it's just front page news. Yeah, to you, it's just news. I mean, he's using the same song, but he's being really kind of, you know, clever and playful with it. And I mean, yeah, the whole, I mean, the song just builds until, you know, this completely anthemic, repetitive refrain of Solidarity in the back. And, you know, I think that when I probably heard this record for the first time, this was probably the song that stuck out with me the most. Mm-hmm. More great bass playing. Have you ever heard them do the slow version of this song that they did live?
God, I feel I must have, but I don't recall it at all. I mean, I saw them, I don't even know, you know, dozens and dozens of times back in the day. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would mess with the speed of their songs live. They would rock stuff out or reggae stuff out mm-hmm. that weren't recorded that way, you know, add whole verses, you know. That's what, they were a great band live.
On YouTube, they have a clip of them playing this live. I guess it was originally from one of those Flipside videos, Flipside video number 9. And it's just a real kind of slowed down version of the song. It's not reggae up or anything. It's just sort of slowed. I don't think there might not even be any drums on it. And it's cool, but if I went to go see Scream Live and they played this song that way, I would have been pissed. I would have been pissed. I think when I saw them, they played it full speed. So, but
that's one of their things. You know, a lot of quotes kind of talk that I've seen kind of talk about that. They, you know, they kind of, in a different way than someone like John Stab, they like to kind of fuck with the audience. So they got a kind of glee out of that. And, you know, as with when they added Harley, the second guitarist, that was like, you know, looked like he just came out of, whatever 80s metal band, who was not even part of the punk scene. You know, they took glee in those moments, you know.
Yeah, so the next song is, I guess, two songs in one. Your Wars and Killer. And Killer, they went outside the pack for some lyrical help from someone named Clark Speaker. Do you know who Clark Speaker is?
Wow. No.
No, I don't. I did a half-hearted attempt to see who he was. There are some other guests, songwriters on this record who I'm familiar with, but not Clark Speaker, but he helped write the lyrics on Killer. So what do you think of this one?
So it's weird because I tend to not like songs like Killer. They just seem a little, I don't know, sensational and silly to me in general, but I really like it on here, especially connected to Your Wars, because there's a reason they're connected. I mean, at least in my mind, my interpretation. Just like how you had mentioned about Red Sea, about Void, this song about this, you know, personal chaos and violence connected to state-funded violence, you know. It's kind of taking it into the personal realm. And so that, to me, that makes it really interesting. And musically, I like the song Killer a little more than Your Wars. Your Wars, to me, is a decent anti-war song. It's good, it's solid, and just like on the other songs, like the main voice I hear the most in the backups, which the backup vocals always make these songs so good, it's like Skeeter's like you know, he's got that like really strong backup vocal sound. The Marshall drumming on Your Wars is very prominent to me. Yeah, I mean, other than that, I mean, I've got some more to say, but, you know, I want to kick it over to you, so go back and so we can get some rounded perspective on this. Like, what's your thought?
I love these two songs. Love them. An absolute highlight for me. Yeah, I like your take on the lyrical content of the two songs. I mean, you know, I've been in bands that have done this too, where it's kind of like two songs that you connect and they kind of always go together. And usually it's not a lyrical thing as it is simply like a musical thing.
Yeah, the chords end up going into each
exactly,
other.
Yeah. That you find. But I do like that interpretation of it. I mean, we've seen songs like Your Wars before. I think on Flex Your Head right there was a song or two about sort of a, you know, an anti-war song. And again, it's going back to the time that these songs were written and the fear of kind of possibly being drafted into war at this time. And, you know, again, this is treading that lyrical ground. And Killer, again, it's sort of like that song Assassin, again, kind of making the violence a little bit more personal. I love Killer. First of all, it's a great transition from one song to the other. I love Killer, where it sort of alternates between this real fast tempo and then like this almost like blast beat part. And one thing, again, that shows some more musical sophistication, we talked about a lot that a lot of the early vocals, where they kind of base the vocal pattern so closely on the rhythms of the songs, and I kind of hate that when that happens. But this is an example of the exact opposite. And what Pete is doing with his vocals is almost exactly the opposite of what the band behind him is doing, because it's a super fast song, but his vocals, he's really, really draws out the words on top of it. And I just, I love it. And it just kind of builds up. It's almost, there's almost a little bit of a false ending at the end where you kind of think the song's going to end. And then it just kicks in for like one final time. And it just, this puts a chill up my spine, this song. This is an absolute favorite and highlight on the record for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, interestingly, it's not one of my favorites. I love it, but it's not, you know, one of the top two or three, I'd say, on here. But, yeah, it's a great song. And to me, it reminds me of, like, a hardcore Damned. Like, there's a, to me, I hear, you know, the two main bands I hear that so much on this record, re-listening over and over again recently, is Bad Brains and the Damned. I hear their influence all over this, and this song definitely has that feel to me. And you know, so also one thing that's interesting is it's like lyrically and just theme wise for Killer, it's almost like the opposite side of the coin of the outsider. It's like the extreme shadow side of the outsider. So like, to me, the positive side of being an outsider is counterculture, is things like, you know, the hardcore scene, etc. Whereas the polar opposite side of being an outsider is that complete alienation, that, you know, darkness and lashing out like violently, as happens in the lyrics of this song. You know, you can read a bit into it. And so the guitar riff, like once there's that, like you said, almost that false ending, and the drums do that fill, and it goes into the guitar riff, the guitar solo thing. It's like, I love that. Like Franz is off the chain. He's almost like an MC5 kind of solo there at the end.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Again, on the whole album, there's a lot of guitar solos on this record that where he's killing it. I also, on Your Wars, is also kind of where I hear yet another influence, where I hear sort of the British influence in the vocals a little bit. I don't know. His vocals on Your Wars, they sort of remind me a little bit of like Charlie Harper from the UK Subs.
Yeah, which isn't out of place, you know. Like he said in that quote, they were, you know, UK Subs, I don't know if he mentioned them in there, but they, you know, the Ruts, the UK Subs. What's the band?
Well, I think I hear a lot of Stiff Little Fingers in there too.
Stiff Little Fingers, for
like
sure.
Like where they kind of mix, like, I think that their brand of like where they, you know, they toy with a little bit of reggae is a little more Stiff Little Fingers than The Clash, except for one maybe notable exception on this record.
Do you think so?
But yeah, because, okay. Yeah, you know, like how Stiff Little Fingers did like Johnny Was and you know, you'll think, Do You Think It's All Right? Yeah, like kind of more like that I hear in their music. I hear a little more Stiff Little Fingers than The Clash in this stuff. But yeah, definitely, you know, again, another influence in play.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, I mean, after that, they go into Piece of Her Time. And, you know, why don't you start us out on that one?
Well, this is another song where they get some outside help. So the music is co-credited with Jason Carmer. He was in 9353. He played with James Williamson, and he was in 00, who we'll be dealing with in a couple of weeks. Yeah, for me, this is another song that has, you know, hey, it's a song about girls. It's got an LA punk feel to it. I hear the Germs in this. Maybe that's appropriate.
Really?
Yeah, I hear a little bit. I mean, again, a more cleaned up version of the Germs, but yeah, I hear a little bit of that, especially in the verses. In fact, it killed me because I was hearing the riff in the verse, and I was really trying to think where I was hearing it from, and I was thinking, there's a specific Germ song where I know that riff came from, and I couldn't find it. And then I realized it actually was an Accused song that I was thinking of.
Really?
The song Take My Time, which is from Return of Martha Splatterhead. I mean, which was written, you know, after this, obviously. But the verse, I mean, it's a little more metallic, the way the Accused play. But it's the same chords. It's the same chord riffs that are going on there. But, you know, I think it's a decent song. I don't think it's one of the standouts musically or lyrically, but you know, it rocks. It has its place, I suppose. So what do you think of this one?
Yeah, I mean, I agree on that point. I think there's some interesting guitar and some interesting backups, but you know, I went and like pored over the lyrics on this because it's really hard to tell if they're being sarcastic or if it's just a straight up lyrics, which, you know, Scream weren't, they were known for their political causes, their political and social consciousness, but not really known for their feminism. So I don't know. I don't know how to take that part of it. But
well, I don't think there's anything wrong with guys in a band writing songs about girls. I mean, you know, that in itself. I think there's another song on this record that's a little more problematic in that department than this one.
Oh, a lot more.
But, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's sure, but it's kind of just talking about, you know, I just want a piece of your time. I just want a casual hookup, you know, one of those, you know, it's kind of like a swaggering 70s rock and roll type of lyric, if it's meant literally, which I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see the same level of sort of cleverness or playfulness with the lyrics in some of the other songs. So I'm just going to take it as, you know, face value.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this is a good place for me, you know, I feel like to say again, like the musicianship is what keeps that song really still interesting enough to, you know, there's not one song on here that I would even consider pulling the needle up and skipping to the next track on. It's all so strong musically and vocally, which is worth mentioning. You know, there's a lot of thought put into the construction of these songs, from the guitar, bass, drums, you know, basic parts to like you said, all the layers of guitar to the layering of the vocals. You know, Pete is super nimble and super agile. That's the word. Pete's super agile with his vocal delivery. Like you said, playful and almost jazzy at times with the way he does his vocals. He's amazing. And the way they craft the backup vocals, you can tell they thought about it. They put a lot of time into making sure these songs had the right amount of every single element, and it makes them more timeless, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, after Piece of Her Time is another song that could be, I couldn't figure out as well, could be about, you know, a love interest, or it could be about an aggressor, you know, or someone you don't understand. Actually, the lyrics on this one are more of a mystery to me as far as what they're getting at. But as for that, for the song Human Behavior, it's got a cool feel, great delivery. Kent sticks out to me on it again. Like, his drumming is just so impressive. But you know, that's pretty much what I have to say about that. What about
you?
Yeah,
I don't have a whole lot to say about this one. You know, it's fast, short, it's thrashy. You know, we do know for a fact that these guys were Bad Brains fans, and you know, it reminds me of the Bad Brains. You know, lyrics again, I don't really feel like every single set of lyrics necessarily needs to be analyzed to death. on it, and I think this falls into that category. You know, it's like music. Like, there are some, you know, bits of music that just stand out at you. It's the same thing with lyrics for me, where sometimes I'll read lyrics, I just don't, you know, I don't absorb them in a certain way. They don't stick out at me. And, you know, this is a record, you know, this does not, you know, you could be right. I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, it's sort of a self-reflective kind of song, and probably dealing with some sort of love interest in some way. But yeah, I don't really, you know, it's again one of the lesser descript songs on the record, but it's good. I mean, it's a good fast punk song.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, you know, well put, and all we need to say about it, really. You know, next is the next anthem on the record.
Oh, yeah.
Stand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, get us going on it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely sort of in the same category as Solidarity. You have sort of, again, Pete doing the call and response verses, an incredibly hooky chorus, an anthemic outro. You know, he's got kind of that little weird spoken part at the end of the song where his vocals are all reverbed up, you know, some fun in the studio, mm-hmm. which I always wonder if that's Ian's influence, because we had talked
about
that.
It was, yeah, that's what Pete yep. said. Yeah.
So, and there's another song, I think on side B, where they also kind of play around with that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's a great hooky anthemic song, just like you said. Yeah, what do you think of Stand?
I love it. I love it, love it, love it. It's so good. And it always, like we said about Solidarity, the first time I heard it, I was like in love with it. I knew this was like the kind of approach to music, the kind of song and intent that I loved about hardcore and about the DC scene, about the band, all that. I love the intro. Skeeter's bass line's pretty cool. Cool way to jump into it. So, you know, it's the kind of song I would listen to as a teenager and older, like, you know, when I wanted to get pumped up and get that sense of PMA and go out in the world, like take that energy out in the world, you know, it's that kind of song.
Yeah. And, you know, they really know how to build and construct a song for that like anthemic coda, you know, just like yeah, they did with definitely. Solidarity, you know, and, no, great, great sing-along song.
Yeah, it's so, so catchy. And, yeah, you know, it's a call to arms. There's a lot of call to arms on this record, and you can't go wrong with that, man.
Yeah, a lot of question marks in this song, you know, a lot of, you know, asking the listener, you know, where they stand, yeah. what they're willing to do.
Exactly. It's there's a lot of kind of grabbing people by the lapels songs, like being like, what, you know, hey, look around you. What's going on? What are you going to do about this? These are people suffering. This world is a mess. Let's make it better.
Yep.
And yeah, you mentioned the echoey thing at the end, you know, the echoey vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kind of see it as, you know, a dub thing, even though it's not a dub song, you know, like they do on Amerirockers and a couple other places. It's kind of that little studio, using the studio as an instrument. Yeah, I love that kind of
yeah.
thing. I think it works well.
No, I do. Yeah. I do too. I completely agree with it. Given that. So,
yeah, so
we close with Fight and American Justice. Another pairing of songs. Two, you know, unlike Your Wars yeah. and Killer, which are, you know, it's kind of similar ballpark musically. Here we have, you know, a nice contrast, I think, between
oh my God,
between
yeah.
Fight and American Justice. Why don't you start us off with this one?
All right. Well, so Fight, as with Police songs, as with Reagan songs at the time, whatever, there's, you know, fighting songs is definitely in the pantheon of early hardcore and early DC, for that matter. But this one is really interesting to me. It's, again, the musicianship off the charts, but it's like, it's really multi-layered. I love it. I love how Pete telescopes out from a personal confrontation to like, hey, let's fight for what we believe in. Let's fight for what's right. You know, it's not just let's fight these fuckers who are fucking with us and don't understand us. It's like, hey, no, let's take it to the streets and fight for what's going for what we believe in. That I love. And I'll wait to talk about American Justice. How about you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I talk about the songs as a pair.
Okay.
Right, yeah. I mean, Fight, which I think is another song that gets someone else gets a credit. Someone named Greg Miller was credited with writing the music for Fight. But yeah, I mean, you know, again, Fight, another fighting song. We've seen the fighting, you know, defending our turf kind of songs before. But then we take a complete left turn as we slow everything down and we go into, you know, sort of a reggae or ska tinge song in American Justice. Great, great bass playing again. Lyrically reminds me of maybe something the Bad Brains would write, you know, commentary on the American justice system. I love that they just have the confidence to lay back and let the song breathe. I mean, this is the longest song on the record. It's just short of 4 minutes. I mean, that's combining the two songs together. And there is just that whole middle part, that whole sort of, you know, breakdown part in the middle, the heavily chorused up guitar solo, and the band is just not in a rush to get to the end. And I love that. You know, that shows a certain confidence of what they're doing. And they're a band that really is they take bold steps sometimes when they kind of stretch out beyond the hardcore songs and experiment with different types of music.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, maybe, you know, a bunch of suburban kids from the United States, people weren't used to hearing, you know, American suburban kids maybe play that kind of music. I don't know. But there's a certain confidence to it. And I think there's another song that's probably a little more successful as far as, the you know, where they branch out. But no, this is a great way to end this first side. It's great. It's exciting. And it just shows two different sides to this band kind of in the same moment, and really showing what these guys were able to do.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it's the first place they unveil their version of reggae punk or punk reggae, whatever. And yeah, I mean, sure, I think Amerirockers does it slightly more successfully because it breathes even more than this one. But this one's a little more mid-tempo, and you know, you say Stiff Little Fingers, I can see that, but I can also see the Clash, like Pressure Drop, something like that. And you know, they're so bold on this. In another band's hands, this would be so cheesy, it could come off so badly, but it works. It's great. Like Pete's kind of toasting, singing over the reggae beat, you know, not quite rapping, but his delivery is just so natural and perfect. And yeah, it's really good. And Franz's, all his guitar embellishments, so creative, you know, you can almost overlook them because they melodically and thematically fit in so well with the song. You know, it was a song that was a great mid-set song because it would give them a chance to kind of slow down and explore a different area. And they would always, I remember Pete would always kind of go off into different rants in the middle of it. It's a great song.
Yeah, and you said how, like, with some other bands, it could come off a little more cheesy. And just right off the top of my head when you said that, I was thinking how, you know, 7 Seconds experimented with some of that. So did the LA Youth Brigade.
Yes, I was just going to say that. Like, it feels in some ways related to Men in Blue.
Yes,
but
I think this is way better.
Know, I do too.
This is
I
way, too. You know, way more successful at achieving that, what they were going for.
Yeah, it ages better, I believe.
Yeah, I agree. So let's take a quick break. Flip the record over.
Exactly.
We're stuck. Sucks begin.